happy spring. Yeah, it's about time. So happy that spring is actually here. And happy March Madness. Let it begin. Should be fun over the next couple of weekends for sure if you're a sports fan. Now, I will hit you with the theme of this episode of The Far Middle right out of the gate. It's farmers. We will talk farmers in sports, the rich history of farmers' political movements in the United States, how farmers are challenging the elites in Europe today, and how farmers have written a chapter in rock history. That's quite an agricultural agenda and a timely one, so we better get started. With the sports dedication, we must check a few boxes here to have a fitting dedication for episode 148. Of course, we're going to need a legend on the field consistent with the prior slew of 100 plus dedication subjects. And we need someone who achieved excellence off the field and that became larger than just a great athlete. That's to stay on theme with about the past two dozen dedications. And then we're going to need a farm boy or a farm girl to fit with the theme of this episode. Now, that's a tall order, isn't it? To check all those boxes with a single dedication subject. But don't you worry, constant listener, we have the perfect dedication subject. This is one of the benefits of having the extensive Far Middle research team at hand 24/7. So who is this person that fits and checks all these boxes? Well, he has some great nicknames. Bullet Bob, Rapid Robert, and the Heater from Van Meter. Our dedication is to Bullet Bob Feller, one of the most dominating pitchers in baseball history. As his nicknames will attest, he earned those monikers. They were not gifted, I assure you. First, consider what he achieved as a player for the Cleveland Indians. He was a teen phenom and signed for $1 and an autographed baseball. And I don't know who signed that baseball, but I would love to know. That would be an interesting bit of sports history for sure. And he started pitching in the majors in the 1930s at 17 years of age, mind you. Feller was an instant national star in what was the country's biggest and most popular sport. His record-setting rookie year made him, according to baseball writer Richard Goldstein, the best-known young person in America, with the possible exception of Shirley Temple. And the great Sports Illustrated writer Frank DeFord, he once wrote about Feller the following. It is difficult to imagine now what a marvel Feller was when he burst upon the scene in 1936, a callow youth of 17. Many athletes are great. Bob Feller was seminal. In the long ago time, unlike nowadays, it was unheard of for teenagers to succeed in the big top of athletics. Feller dressed in the uniform of the Major League Cleveland Indians, striking out, fanning American demigods in the only professional team sport that mattered then in the United States. That's again from the great Frank DeFord. He was on the cover, Feller was, of Time magazine in 1937, still as a teenager. His high school graduation ceremony was covered on national radio, and he was a power pitcher extraordinaire, legendary fastball. He logged some of the greatest single seasons in the history of pitching, notably 1940, 1941, and 1946. He was, in a word, dominant. Yet Rapid Robert's career numbers, they're great, but they're not epic. His career stats don't live up to his career domination and single season achievements. I'll give you an example. He didn't achieve 300 career wins, which is a career pitching milestone for the greatest of the greats. But there's a reason why that checks another box, making Feller a fitting dedication. There's a reason why for this, and it's a great one. He served 4 years in the Navy during World War II, proving to be another great American who transcended sport. Feller heard about the Pearl Harbor bombing, and 2 days later, he volunteered for the U.S. Navy, becoming the first American professional athlete to enlist. How about that? And originally, he tried to enlist as a fighter pilot, but he failed hearing tests. Although he had received a military exemption owing to his father's failing health, he wanted to serve in combat missions. Feller said, "I told them I wanted to get into combat. Wanted to do something besides standing around handing out balls and bats and making ball fields out of coral reefs." Feller was eventually assigned to the battleship USS Alabama. He was a gun captain on the Alabama, and the Alabama was in the Atlantic Theater and then was reassigned to the Pacific Theater, which is where Feller first encountered direct combat. After the war, back to the Indians, where he continued to dominate. He won a World Series in 1948, and over the course of his career, he led the American League in strikeouts 7 times. Upon his retirement, Fowler was number 3 all-time in strikeouts career-wise, behind only Walter Johnson and Cy Young. And his career numbers would have been astronomical if he played those years during World War II instead of being in combat. But then that wouldn't be Bob Fowler, would it? Who I think of as a combat vet first and a pitcher second. And let's close the loop with Rapid Robert by tying back to Farmers and one of his other nicknames, the Heater from Van Meter. You see, Fowler was a farm boy growing up in Iowa in the small town of Van Meter. His family farm still stands today, and the city hall there houses the Bob Fowler Museum. Bob Fowler is one of the greatest generation. In 2013, the Bob Fowler Act of Valor Award was created to honor the life of Fowler, and the award recognizes individuals that possess the values, integrity, and dedication to serving our country that Bob Fowler himself displayed. The least we can do on the far middle is to honor him with this dedication. Bob Fowler, being born and raised on a farm, makes for a nice connection to an interesting topic, how farmers in America have a history of political activism. Go back to the 19th century when economic advancement and technology, they combined to affect industry and agriculture. Steamships and railroads were game changers, and along with new machinery and foreign trade, they disrupted everything from the factory to the farm. But net-net, manufacturing in urban areas, they benefited much more from the innovation in this revolution than agriculture did in rural areas, especially when it came to the individual farmer and to small towns. Yes, cities got bigger, industry became more profitable, but farmers, in some ways, they struggled more. That's because farming still lacked scale and competition was global when it came to the demand and the pricing for crops. Said differently, the farmer was dependent on one hand on the global market for his revenue, but he still had his costs set by an inefficient local or regional market. And that created a financial pinch of at-risk revenue and sometimes low revenue, but yet also high cost. Add to this farmer's challenge the fact that farmers often had to use credit and they ran up debt as well as having to carry the risk of storage of crop and transportation of crop, land lease rents and speculators within submarkets or subregions. And you can see that the American farmer was facing increasing headwinds to just simply making a go of it in the latter half of the 1800s. So farmers decided it was time to unite and become activists to support their cause. And they initially looked to the labor movement in larger cities as the model to follow. There first was the Patrons of Husbandry, or what was also known as the Grange, that appeared in the rural areas of the South and the West, and it turned into a political movement that focused on setting caps on rail rates, which were a key point of contention and a big risk for farmers in the South and the West. The organization, by the way, is alive and well today with a Washington, D.C. headquarters and many small farming towns having a Grange Hall. Then came the Greenback Movement, which focused on currency and inflation issues as key problems facing farmers. The Greenback Movement advocated for more money, breaking from the gold standard and a cheaper dollar, almost reflecting what today we would call modern monetary theory, or MMT, and what some would call fiat money. Even though the Greenback Party ran candidates for president over 3 elections, it wasn't very successful politically, but the movement was successful in calling attention to the need to fix what would appear to be an obsolete monetary system in the United States at the time. And around the same time with the Greenback Party came the Farmers' Alliances in both the Northwest and the South. The idea was to unite farmers politically to form a force and establish party politics and to take on the Gilded Age. In the South, the Southern Alliance, as it was known, focused on taking over the dominant Democratic Party by electing their candidates to run for state offices and for Congress, while in the Northwest, the Farmers' Alliance started to feel like more of a separate third party that was populist in nature. And speaking of populist, the fourth and probably most impactful farmers' movement was the Populists, centered out in the West and also having support in the South. Now, it was called different things. It went by different names. It was known as the People's Party, the Populists, or the Populist Party. And lack of rainfall got things moving with this movement. You see, drought devastated farmers in the Plains region in the late 1880s, and farms began to fail. Farmers felt the business interests of railroads and bankers were contributing and feeding off of their plight, and they wanted to do something about it. And that started quite a passionate and rabid movement with followers preaching populism. The People's Party candidate for president, James Weaver, ended up winning 22 electoral college votes in the 1892 election and won 4 Western states outright, and that party won electoral votes in 2 others. But the party eventually merged into the Democratic Party in the next presidential election in 1896. Although as a distinct political party, the People's Party died, many of its ideas lived on. Subsequent policies in the coming years affecting conservation, trusts, railroads, banking, they all can trace roots back to the populism of the farmers in the late 1800s, including, by the way, the ultimate creation of the Federal Reserve and a lot of Teddy Roosevelt's ultimate platform and accomplishments as president. I must give special thanks to John D. Hicks, who was a noted historian in the 1930s and who focused and wrote on populism and farmers' movements. If you're interested in the subject, check out some of his works from way back, again, in the 1930s when he was publishing. You can find some of those works online and buy some of his books on the reused or used book market. But the American farmer acting up in the late 1800s, it makes a perfect connection to European farmers acting up in 2024. Over 100 years and an ocean in between the two, but there is so much in common, all boiling down to the common farmer lining up against the arrogant elite. So let's explore what's going on with European farmers today. I think it'll be a harbinger for what might occur here in the States not too far from now. Farmers are protesting all over Europe. Spain, Italy, Greece, Hungary, Netherlands, France, Portugal, Belgium, Germany, Poland, basically from Romania to Ireland, damn near every country within Europe and truly pan-European. And you may have seen the videos and clips of tractors and convoys of farming equipment blocking roads and of farmers dumping wine and feed and other stuff in front of government buildings. And the protests aren't just the farmers in these nations, but also organizations that are affiliated with farmers and with agriculture. These institutions have joined what was originally grassroots into something bigger and more organized. And the movement is starting to win elections from the local to the national. A big example of that is what we've seen in the Netherlands. Governments in the EU, they are freaking out instead of listening. Spain issued thousands of sanctions or violations against citizens under its Orwellian citizen security law, which has the more popular moniker of the gag law. But still, Barcelona was brought to a standstill by the protesters, and Spanish farmers still dumped wine in front of a municipal water authority to protest against water restrictions. Italy saw 1,600 tractors poised to enter Rome. Milan had a cow join in the street protest, which was pretty funny to see. And what were they protesting? The expiration of an income tax exemption in Italy, which the Italian prime minister now agreed to not let expire. Greece, same story. It's seen protests everywhere. And the highway to Athens saw itself being blocked. The Netherlands, I mentioned them, they got things rolling with the farmers' citizens movement. Now everyone is paying attention and saying they feel for the farmers being victimized by the EU bureaucracy and the elites who run it. Now, Germany is an interesting case all in of itself. It tried to originally cover up the cost of climate policies by using pandemic emergency funds, which I suppose would be a nice trick until the court said it was unlawful since, you know, climate change is not COVID. Duh. So the German government and its leaders said that the climate costs and the spending on climate programs, that's going to continue, but now it would be paid for by removing diesel fuel subsidies to the German farmer, which added to increased costs that were already rising for farmers that were being created by other climate policies within the German net zero nightmare, which then stripped away the pretend veneer of net zero plans not hurting anybody. So German farmers reacted, and Germany saw roads blocked from Munich to Berlin. And I saw some iconic photos, I'm not sure if you did, of farmer tractors blocking the Brandenburg Gate approaches in Berlin. Those experts out there and the media, they are blaming 5 root causes for catalyzing these farm protests. They point to climate policies, inflation, food imports, the urban-rural divide and economic inequality. Now, that's sort of true, but not really. Let's jump connections and walk through each of those five root causes that have been identified to see why it's a case of not really. So let's start with climate policies. Yes, the European Green Deal is wrecking European farmers, no doubt, as was the plan of climate policies from the get-go, to make it uneconomic to farm and to feed and to eat. So in turn, the bureaucrat and the state can tell you what you will eat and how much, all under the false flag of Code Red, saving the planet in that nice optical cloak of sustainable farming, whatever that is. Now, farmers quickly understood these policies when it comes to climate policies that were coming after them right after they came after fossil fuels and the grid and gasoline-powered cars. And the farmers aren't taking that lying down. Now, go to the second sort of proffered excuse or root cause, which is inflation. Yes, the cost of living and inflation are up. Natural gas costs are up, and so is fertilizer cost. Farming needs carbon-based inputs just like about everything else. So if you create scarcity and you inflate the cost of energy with climate policies, guess what? You do the same for the inputs of farming. Thus, farming becomes uneconomic. Now, the expert in the media, they point to this issue of inflation, and they want to pin the blame on Russia invading Ukraine, which then increased energy costs. Or they say drought, caused by, of course, climate change, that's raising costs, which is 100% bogus. The true root cause is the same as the first driver, climate policies. Those policies caused both Russia's invasion as well as inflation. And yes, somewhere in Europe right now, there's going to be drought. And somewhere in the same Europe right now, there's going to be floods. It is a continent, for goodness sake. The climate isn't causing the plight of farmers or inflation. Climate change policies are. Nice try, media. Now, there's also the sort of root cause that's been assigned of imports. No doubt farmers are getting hit by imports, but that's another symptom of climate change policies that dictate who makes and who uses what on a global scale. Nations lose autonomy under all climate policies, from domestic energy industries to who grows the food. Climate policies are built to make European-grown food too expensive, which then aims to make food scarcer and to shift the lower supply of food from European to foreign providers, with Europe looking to places like North Africa and the Ukraine. Not exactly geopolitically stable places to be getting your bread or your dinner from. Then there is the excuse of the rural-urban divide. It's not that urban doesn't care about rural. The government bureaucrat and the elite, they care greatly. The problem is they care about placing the rural, or what we call flyover country here in America, in economic chains and assign them to a life of reliance on the state and the expert. Is it any wonder that rural Europeans tend to be more Euroskeptic? I think they might be smarter than the urban elites give them credit for. And when it comes to economic inequality, that fifth and final root cause or excuse that is proffered by media and the expert class is a cause of the farmer protests across Europe. I can't think of anything that is a more regressive tax and a regressive value appropriator than net zero plans and climate change policies. Net zero plans radically catalyze income inequality. And like these other issues, the media wants to label economic inequality as a root cause of the farmer protests. Yet economic inequality is a symptom of the true root cause here, which are climate policies and net zero scams. So where does it go from here? Well, actually, I'm quite optimistic about the implications of European farmers standing up for themselves. Let me tell you why. Three reasons why. First, the shorter-term successes that were obtained by political leaders in nations like France and Italy backing off of planned moves, those are successes for the farmers' movement, and that's created an incentive for farmers in other European nations to join the movement. And you saw the consequence of this with the protests not just spreading across Europe, but also being extended through February and in some places beyond. Second reason that I'm optimistic, the reaction of the farmers to these climate policies under the whole climate change movement umbrella, it's created a deterrent effect for politicians and bureaucrats across Europe, making them think twice before unleashing additional and similar draconian moves on other sectors of the European economy and society. Effectively, the farmers provided a great service to a host of other stakeholders who would have soon been feeling the crunch of climate policy tactics, but for the farmers' resistance. And then the third reason I'm optimistic, the farmers' protest movement is winning elections. Many local ones and even national ones. We mentioned what was happening in Netherlands. And with those opposed to economy-killing climate policies trouncing leftist parties obsessed about climate change and code red creating irreversible state control. And once again, you see a complicit media trying to cover for the bureaucrat in Europe. Now you hear in the face of overwhelming evidence of political upheaval and protest by farmers that what this is precipitating is a needed discussion about who pays for climate change policies and net zero plans, which is a nonsensical position to take because a quick analysis shows that everyone pays for climate change policies and net zero plans in a modern economy. It's not a question about who pays. Instead, it comes down to how transparent will the costs that are being borne be brought to light and how soon? Do people wake up before you've reached the point of no return? Or do the policies become so embedded within an economy and society that it doesn't matter what happens once society wakes up? So here is to the European farmers acting as both a moral and economic alarm clock to hopefully wake up society before it's too late. Yes, farmers matter greatly in society. Let's not mess with them. One of the great value creator classes in America with those creators, enablers, and servers making society function, as I wrote about them in my book, Precipice. And unfortunately, farmers are finding themselves under attack with this ever-pressing value appropriation by who what might some call the takers, and that I reference in Precipice as the leech. I did write up a commentary on this subject of the farmers' movement in American history, along with what's going on in Europe today with the farmer protests. You can read that on nickdeolius.com or across social media on X, as well as on LinkedIn under Nick Deolius, if you want to give that a look. So let's close this episode where we opened it and where we spent the entire time, the farmer and farms. But we're going to make a final connection to those topics with a musical twist. It's hard to believe, but it's been almost 40 years since the first Farm Aid concert, which was held in Champaign, Illinois. I remember that concert back in the mid-80s. It certainly had an all-star lineup, Johnny Cash, the Beach Boys, of course, the Farm Aid stalwarts of John Mellencamp and Willie Nelson, they were there, Waylon Jennings, Emmylou Harris, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, I think Billy Joel was at that first one, Tom Petty, Don Henley, on and on, just a mind-boggling lineup. But what I most remember from that first Farm Aid concert, it was the first public appearance of two key members of a new lineup of the biggest band in rock at the time, the band being Van Halen. Yes, Farm Aid number one was also the first time that Eddie Van Halen and Sammy Hagar appeared together performing on stage. News that they were forming the new version of Van Halen 2.0 hit just prior to that Farm Aid concert, and out came Eddie and Sammy performing a cover of Led Zeppelin's Rock and Roll. Now, watching that on TV, and it was TV because this was before internet and social media and streaming, it was quite the treat for scores of music-obsessed teenagers and young adults, and your host was one of those. Eddie joined Sammy at the end of Sammy's solo set at Farm Aid. I don't know if they played anything after the rock and roll cover to this day, because the live TV broadcast cut to a damn commercial when they ended their cover of Rock and Roll. That's right, TV cut away from Eddie Van Halen. Damn it. And TV would not commit an atrocity of similar magnitude until years later, when it snubbed and cut to commercial when Frank Sinatra was making his emotional acceptance speech for his Legend Award at the Grammys in 1994. By the way, remember who introduced Sinatra at that Grammy event? None other than Bono. He did a great job with his intro speech. But back to Farm Aid, a great example of when Americans cared about other Americans. Today, I hope that focus is alive, but I do worry. You see on the Farm Aid website today the obligatory genuflecting at the altar of climate change. That's unfortunate. Maybe it's time to get back to Americans caring about Americans instead of worrying about the abstract, the unknowable, or about future climate. And maybe it's time that Europeans start worrying first and foremost about fellow Europeans, and so on with Italians, French, and Germans. Perhaps that more than anything is the core message being delivered by European farmers today and potentially American farmers once again tomorrow. And we should thank them for it. I'll take the farmer, you can have the bureaucrat. And you can also have another episode of the Farm Middle next week. Till then, goodbye.